Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017. It's time to get out of Afghanistan. That's what Donald Trump wrote on Twitter back in February 2012. He was beginning to think about running for president then. He tweeted, "We are building roads and schools for people that hate us. It is not in our national interests." And for progressives who found Trump's promise of being less interventionist one of the few policies they could get behind, even that isn't in the cards.
I am here tonight to lay out our path forward in Afghanistan and South Asia.
But Trump didn't lay out his plans in a speech last night in front of military personnel in Fort Myers, Virginia, and to a televised national audience. What he did was he gave voice to vague plans, which turns authority over to his defense secretary, James Mad Dog Mattis, and generals under Mattis's supervision to dictate tactics to be used in Afghanistan. By this, Donald Trump changed strategy, which restricted rules of engagement. Instead of U.S. troops fulfilling functions like training the Afghan forces, surveillance, intelligence, and logistics, he says U.S. troops will fight. And he didn't specify how many troops he's sending to Afghanistan.
To prosecute this war, we will learn from history. As a result of our comprehensive review, American strategy in Afghanistan and South Asia will change dramatically in the following ways. A core pillar of our new strategy is a shift from a time-based approach to one based on conditions. I've said it many times how counterproductive it is for the United States to announce in advance the dates we intend to begin or end military options. We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military activities. Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on. America's enemies must never know our plans or believe they can wait us out. I will not say when we are going to attack, but attack we will.
Today, former Exxon CEO, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson applauded the approach Trump outlined.
I think the president did a, fairly thorough job in terms of describing the new military approach. And I think the important point in that is a conditions-based approach as opposed to a time-based approach that had specified troop ceiling levels and timetables. And I think the president's been quite clear that what is will be different this time is he has empowered our military commanders on the ground to make more timely decisions, to conduct battlefield operations based upon the conditions on the ground with the battle plans that Secretary of Defense Mattis will be approving. That is going to change the dynamic on the ground considerably.
With thousands upon thousands dead, the U.S. has been in Afghanistan for almost 17 years. U.S. intelligence traced a link between the hijackers, al-Qaeda operatives who had carried out the attacks, 9/11, and Afghan's Taliban. In response, 4 weeks after those attacks, the U.S., with NATO support, launched Operation Enduring Freedom against the Taliban and the al-Qaeda fighters being sheltered in Afghanistan. Now the Taliban controls about 60% of the country, and talk of negotiations with them seems to be on the back burners. And while 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, there was no mention made of Saudi Arabia by Trump or Tillerson. Saudi Arabia, where the Trump administration sealed a weapons deal worth nearly $110 billion, $350 billion over 10 years. There's an online petition to the members of Congress from winwithoutwar.org. It says, after 16 years of failed war, it's time to admit that what we're doing in Afghanistan just isn't working. The petition calls on members of Congress to send a strong, unwavering message to Donald Trump that he must immediately rethink the decision to put more troops in Afghanistan. If you want to sign on to that petition, it's at winwithoutwar.org. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York. Turning to the U.S. and North Korea. Today, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on 16 mainly Chinese and Russian companies and people for assisting North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs and helping the North make money to support those programs. The Treasury Department said the penalties are intended to complement new UN Security Council sanctions and to further isolate North Korea for its nuclear and missile test amid heightened tensions, which have led to threats from both sides. Meanwhile, North Korea's envoy to UN disarmament talks says military threats and pressure from the United States are only serving to drive his country to further develop a nuclear deterrence. Diplomat Yoo Young-choi said today that other countries which spoke at a conference on disarmament session against Pyongyang's nuclear weapons and missile tests had been siding with the hostile U.S. position. The envoy accused Washington of attempting to shift the blame for the tense situation on the Korean Peninsula to DPRK. U.S. Ambassador Robert Wood warned that North Korea's ballistic missile and nuclear weapons programs pose grave threats to the entire world. And he said its recent intercontinental ballistic missile tests showed dangerous and reckless behavior of the North. Meanwhile, North Korea vowed merciless retaliation against U.S. South Korean military drills, which it claims are an invasion rehearsal. The drills began yesterday.
Diplomacy! Donald Trump! Kim Jong-un! Do not fight the wars of goons! Donald Trump! Kim Jong-un! Do not fight the wars of goons! Donald Trump! Kim Jong-un! Do not fight the wars of goons! Donald Trump! Kim Jong-un! Do not fight the wars of goons!
Here in New York City, outside Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's office, activists gathered to show opposition to Schumer and Senator Gillibrand for their foreign policy positions. Kate Alexander is Policy Director for New York State's Peace Action.
We're here outside of Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand's offices because Democrats do not have a foreign policy with North Korea that is distinguishable from what this administration is doing. Whatever party it is, both have chosen military aggression, and that is to our own detriment. $1.2 trillion to the modernization of nuclear weapons, which was proposed by the Obama administration and is being pursued by the Trump administration. That amount of money could cancel all student debt in the U.S. What's an investment more worth making? They have made a decision, but they can always revisit. In fact, after a few town halls, including a Queens town hall, where I asked Gillibrand a question about the Israeli Anti-Boycott Act, she did reconsider her position. It's proof that these decisions can be reconsidered. And we've defended diplomacy before. It's what we did with the Iran deal. You don't make peace deals with your friends. You make them with people who have agitated you. And that's what we need to do again, but this time with North Korea. There are diplomatic options on the table, and both parties are letting them be ignored. And that's unacceptable.
Alexander says the Restricting First Use of Nuclear Weapons Act of 2017 needs to pass both houses immediately. The bill prohibits Donald Trump from using the armed forces to conduct a first-use nuclear strike unless the strike is in accordance with a declaration of war by Congress. The bill was introduced by Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts at the end of January.
Senators Schumer and Gillibrand and really the entire Democratic Party should be rallying behind the Restricting First Use of Nuclear Weapons Act. In the Senate, it's S-200. In the House, it's H.R. 669. This would ensure that Trump does not have the authority to use nuclear weapons without authorization from Congress. We simply cannot face the consequences of launching a nuclear weapon anywhere in the world. I don't think we can risk what Trump will do without congressional debate when it comes to war powers and when it comes to nuclear weapons.
I'm Alice Slater. I'm with the World Beyond War Network and 100 other networks. And I think we really have to look at our history about what's going on in Korea. I myself was not aware that we still have 28,000 troops on their border. that they've been rattling their sabers at us for years trying to get a peace treaty going. And we just had this incredible movement at the United Nations where the non-nuclear weapon states negotiated a ban treaty to ban nuclear weapons and prohibit them. And North Korea voted for it in the General Assembly. They weren't at the final vote, but they were the only nuclear weapon state out of all the nine that voted for it. So it's just terrible for us to be playing war games there. There were only two senators that voted against these new sanctions against Iran, North Korea, and Russia, and that was Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders. And Bernie said if it weren't for Iran, he would have voted against North Korea and Russia. So he's not such a great help either, although he's great on economic and social issues. So we have nobody. Even Bannon, the Nazi horror story, didn't want to go to war with North Korea. So now the generals have won. It's just really insane.
No more war!
My name is Jerry Hassett. I'm with the Veterans for Peace. And I'm here try and stop this nonsense with nuclear, but anything we've been doing with Korea since 1950, it's insidious, that's what it is. We can't sign a peace treaty, we just continue testing and testing. Nobody talks about us doing all the testing out in the Pacific and all around China and Guam and all up the Pacific there.
No more war!
Hyun Lee is with No to Door. It's a Korean-American organization that stands for the reunification of the Korean Peninsula.
I hope in terms of the Korea conflict, what could happen is a freeze for a freeze, which many people, including North Korea, China, Russia, and many Korea experts in Washington, D.C. support, which means that the U.S. should freeze its military exercises, North Korea should freeze its nuclear and missile tests, and then move towards dialogue and diplomacy towards ending the Korean War and signing a peace treaty.
Lee points to the length of the U.S. occupation in Afghanistan.
How long have we been in Afghanistan? For, you know, we were promised that it was going to be a quick war. It's been, 15 years now, and it has completely destabilized the entire region. Not just the region, but now it's creating violence in Europe, all over the world. And it started with U.S. aggression. And I think we need to remember that when Trump is considering another war in a completely different region, a region that is very critical to the global economy, any war is not going to be quick. It's going to be protracted. It's going to be destabilizing. And it's not in anyone's interest. And so I think that more people in the United States need to stand up and say no war. No new war in Korea, and also continued war in the Middle East.
North Korea has described Donald Trump as a leader who frequently tweets, quote, weird articles of his ego-driven thoughts, unquote, and, quote, spouts rubbish, unquote, to give his assistants a hard time. North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency made the comments today in response to tough talk in Washington and Seoul over threats posed by the North's nuclear and missile programs. In other news, a new United Nations report urges Iraq's government to do more to help thousands of women and girls who faced rape, sexual abuse, and other violations by the Islamic State group. The report by the UN Rights Office and the UN Mission in Iraq makes recommendations about ways to improve justice, increase accountability, and allow for reparations for victims as IS's territorial control has been dwindling. Although the report, which was released today, notes some successes, it says Iraq's criminal justice system largely fails to adequately protect abused women and girls subjected to sexual and other violence. The report also urges authorities to avoid recording information on a child's birth certificate about the father that could lead to discrimination or possible violence, such as among children of fathers who fought for IS. Meanwhile, UN agencies in Iraq are gearing up to help thousands of civilians expected to flee a city there, Tel Afar. It's a northern city which has been under the control of the terrorist group IS for the past 3 years. The Iraqi military has launched an operation to retake Tel Afar and surrounding communities from extremists. Deanne Penn reports.
The offensive began on Sunday, and the UN estimates that so far up to 40,000 people have already fled the northern city. Andrei Mahecic is a spokesperson with the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR.
Tell Afar in Nineveh province, some 65 kilometers northwest of Mosul, fell under the control of extremist armed groups in 2014. Its pre-conflict population was thought to be around 200,000 people. Since April this year, more than 30,000 people fled Tel Afar district, many living in camps, sheltering other families, also mainly displaced from Mosul.
Humanitarians have not been able to access Tel Afar since 2014. It's feared thousands could still be inside the city, where conditions are said to be extremely difficult. UNHCR reports that residents have been surviving on unclean water and bread over the past 3 to 4 months.
We fear that Iraqi civilians are likely to be held as human shields again, and that attempts to flee could result in executions and shootings. We call on all parties to the conflict to allow civilians to leave the conflict area and to access safety. We are also concerned about the reports that in some instances displaced Iraqi families from Tel Afar are being denied access to safety in locations that have capacity to absorb them.
Many families who have escaped are walking up to 20 hours in blistering heat to reach safety. They're arriving at UN sites exhausted, dehydrated, and in poor health. Olivia Hedden is a spokesperson with IOM, the International Organization for Migration.
A lot of people who've arrived in our emergency sites require urgent medical care. We're seeing a lot of traumatic injuries, including fractured limbs sustained as a result of the conflict. We're also seeing severely malnourished children, people with gastritis and upper respiratory infections. We're providing medical care, shelter, and non-food items such as mattresses, fans, hygiene kits, solar lights.
The World Health Organization, WHO, is also supporting civilians who have escaped from Tel Afar. WHO is focusing on providing trauma care in areas as close to the fighting as possible. The goal is to treat people early after they have sustained a traumatic injury, which greatly boosts their survival. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York. Turning to local news, there's a sculpture here in New York City which is raising much concern. It's of a physician, J. Marion Sims, who practiced gynecology in the 1800s. Some call him the father of gynecology because of surgical repair of complications of obstructed childbirth he pioneered, but what he did was totally unethical. New York City Council member from Northern Manhattan, Mark Levine, is chair of the City Council's Parks Committee.
Well, my capacity as Parks Chair, I find it to be unacceptable that a statue given a prominent place in a public park, in this case on the edge of Central Park, venerates a man who conducted unanesthetized medical experiments on enslaved black women who obviously were unable to give their consent, who undoubtedly suffered terribly in the course of these experiments. As a Jewish person, it's reminiscent to me of one of the greatest villains of the Holocaust, who was a doctor, Joseph Mengele, who at Auschwitz conducted similar experiments on prisoners, mostly Jewish prisoners, ostensibly in the name of science, but they were sadistic and inhumane and reprehensible. There would never be a statue to Joseph Mengele in Germany. There shouldn't be a statue to a doctor who conducted similar experiments here in America. And so we're calling for the immediate removal of the statue here on the edge of Central Park.
WBAI's Akeem Killick spoke with Diane Collier. She's chair of Community Board 11 in East Harlem about the campaign to remove the statue.
Well, I wanted to, of course, for everyone to be aware of who this statue is, what this statue is, because very few people know it, and they pass by it every day. This is an opportunity to spread the word about what the statue is about, and second, to reiterate the community board's call to take it down.
Was it the campaign before Charlottesville events?
We've been campaigning about this. We've been advocating for 7 years now. It started in 2010 when it came to our attention through a book called Medical Apartheid.
So could you tell a bit about campaign?
Well, it was an advocacy on our behalf when it came to us that this statue was before us, and that it should, it was people in the community that felt that this statue should be removed. So we began discussions with Parks and Recreations, the agency. They've been kind of resistant to it, but in about 4 years after we were continually talking about it, suddenly they came back and they said, well, we could put the information about the women who were experimented on the statue, and we'll get back to you. They got back to us in June of 2016, and they presented the plaque, and to which the board said no. Because the plaque had the names of the women, the plaque had the names, what their contributions to gynecology. But if you look at the statue, where could it have been placed? The only place that was open would have been at the feet of the statue. So you're tying the victims to the oppressor for an eternity under his feet. Just the pure symbolism was like, no. And it's not enough to put the names of the women. It's to take the statue down. And that's what we did in 2016. We reiterated the call to take the statue down.
Since we are from WBAI, do you have any message to our listeners what they should do?
To write the mayor and insist, particularly women, because you heard me say what happened. And those are just some of the things that happened to the women. Like I said, they were operated on repeatedly without anesthesia, repeatedly given opium after the operation. They were exposed, displayed with a disfigured body before men, strange men. All of these are humiliating to any woman. And I encourage any woman who hears my voice, send a letter to the mayor and say, this statue should be removed.
The book referred to is by Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid, Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present.
I've been reading, catching up on the news with all the statues, everything that's been happening with the statues around the country.
Marielle Vasquez from the Bronx traveled to Manhattan to check out this statue.
And a friend of mine last night sent me an article about this particular guy and how his work affected the women of Puerto Rico back in time, and how they were sterilized without knowing what was happening to them.
Vasquez says she finds statues like this very disturbing.
That in our past history in this country and in this city, they have erected statues to individuals who didn't necessarily do anything that really helped anybody besides themselves, meaning, you know, white people. So when, for example, the work that he did in trying to sterilize women of color to reduce that population, I question what was the motive? Why was he using them as if they were guinea pigs? Why couldn't they just use animals? And I know there's a lot of animal people that are protecting animals now also. So I like to think that maybe it was ignorance on their part, which, yes, it has to be ignorance on their part to not be able to see people of color as human beings, just like themselves. But there seems to have benefited them to keep people of color ignorant, to keep them uneducated, and therefore they can do whatever they want with them and, you know, remain in power. Because it's all about power, I think, you know. Those that have power want to stay in power, and they will go to extreme lengths to keep it. So if it means subjugating people of color, if it means supposedly helping to control a certain population, they will do that. They stoop to that level. And so in Puerto Rico, back in the, as early as I think the 1930s, they came across Puerto Rican women who were in their 20s, and they gave them this idea, oh, you can tie your tubes. They presented it with the idea, you can tie your tubes, which made them think that later on, when they were ready to have children, they cannot tie them. But in actuality, what happened was they got sterilized, period. So that was a whole generation of children in Puerto Rico that were not born. And I don't think that was right. And so this guy had something to do with it. Why is his statue here? We don't need statues of people that do that kind of stuff to humanity. So I think it should come down.
J. Marion Sims performed examinations on enslaved black women between 1845 and 1849. The drive to remove the statue from Central Park near 103rd Street and Fifth Avenue is part of a campaign to remove symbols of hate on New York City properties. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017. The news was produced with Matt Patterson, Rebecca Miles, Mitchell Cohen, Deanne Penn, Akim Killick, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.